According to the National Institute of Mental Health, nearly one in five U.S. adults live with a mental illness. That's over 50 million Americans. Are we, as a country, doing enough to care for them? And what can we do better? Joining us to discuss is Dr. John Newcomer, the president and CEO of Thriving Mind South Florida. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Moshe.
So I want to talk a little bit about Thriving Mind, but I also want to say that I am honored to be a part of the organization. But let's tell the audience a little bit about what you do in Thriving Mind.
Yeah, so let me frame this for your national audience, sort of big picture. Every state in the country has a safety net for mental health and substance use treatment for people who are uninsured or underinsured, particularly those living below like 200% of the federal poverty level. There's always some system in place. Of course, some states fund it more, some states fund it less, but there's a safety net system. Here in Florida, this system is supported by seven nonprofits. We're one of them around the state. We have super low overhead, less than 5%, but we end up funding a network of healthcare provider organizations to support the needs of folks having these kinds of issues and making sure that they get the services that they need to be connected with.
So when I think about, two boxes, I think about when it comes to mental health, is mental illness, and then we talk about substance abuse. Is there an overlap between the two?
Yeah, so really great point. So first of all, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, this is one of the NIH, National Institutes of Health Institutes, and the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, they have repeatedly tried to point out to all of us that these conditions overlap. In other words, if you have somebody who's gotten depressed, they're at very high risk for self-medicating or otherwise falling into a substance use condition. If you have someone with a substance use condition, they're at very high risk for developing a mental health condition. And, you know, I think that that's kind of the first point of overlap. And then maybe, Moshe, we could at some point talk to the group about there's mental health and substance use disorders. And then there's the huge, you know, population who get exposed to mental health challenges. It may not rise to the level right now. It's not rising to the level of a mental health disorder. But we really want to make sure that everybody is taking good care of themselves and getting access to early needed support, so that it doesn't go downhill and turn into a more serious condition.
So are there people that do see that they have a mental health issue and they don't have access to where to go? In other words, walk us through, if somebody realizes, you know, they're deeply depressed, maybe they have bipolar, maybe they have substance issues, what is the typical process? In other words, does everybody have access for material help?
No, it's a great question. So I think the answer is in two channels. Part of it is that in different states around the country, there's different levels of awareness, you know, promotion of access to funded services for those folks. But what's really fascinating, Moshe, is that even in states that have extremely high levels of available services, remember, something about the brain, you know, challenges, like if I get a mental health condition, if I have a substance use condition, it's impacting my brain's ability to even see that I have a problem. And so what you often see is that even in communities where there are rich available services, You can see that there was a famous study, you know, done mostly on Long Island in New York. And it turned out that people who had families who had somebody with a new onset psychotic disorder, you know, hallucinations, delusions, they were having their beginning of an illness, a very serious illness called schizophrenia, that the average length of time that it took for those folks to get connected with services was approaching 2 years.
Wow.
Untreated illness.
So I think I was reading, maybe that has to do with a deep need of, first of all, the stigma that society has. So first of all, what do we do to negate or neutralize that stigma to ask for help? What would you say action plan, different suggestions to on a national level that that we can negate or neutralize that stigma?
Yeah, and listen, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants here, you know, saying this. I mean, there's a lot of thought that's gone into the answer to your great question. I think it's really a full court press, right? It's a multi-pronged approach. One issue is battling the stigma, just like you said. Part of that is raising awareness, you know, not only about, you know, these are treatable medical conditions. This is just like developing type 2 diabetes. If I develop a treatable medical condition called major depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, I mean, if I get the treatment, my outcome is going to be a whole lot better, you know, than if I don't. And I deserve that treatment and I should have equal payer access, you know, to that. So it's, you know, awareness, reduce stigma, but also to your big question about access, you know, and making sure that there's no wrong door and there's an easy way for people to find the pathway into treatment. And I think everybody probably on this podcast knows that in all of our communities around the country, it is sometimes a labyrinth. You know, it's difficult to find your way through the complicated systems to figure out, you know, does my insurance pay for this or that? And who's the best person to treat what I've got?
A lot of the work that you do is working with children with severe emotional trauma. How important is it that they get the help that they need at a younger age?
Time is of the essence. And it's for two reasons. You know, time is of the essence in, right, number one, because if the child is waiting longer, right, there's more disruption in the family. Remember, kids are learning like sponges. I mean, we all have our experience with our own children. We know that like 6 month delay in their ability to be drinking in all that knowledge and growing and developing really could change their course. You know, that's number one. And number two is there's a growing amount of scientific evidence. It's really robust at this point that if you leave some of these diseases, it's an illness, right? This is not a failure of will. It's not a failure correct thinking or something like that. People who develop serious mental illnesses are having a problem with brain function. And if we can treat them early, they have a much better outcome. The more time that passes without treatment, depending on the illness, there's a lot of evidence now for changes in brain structure, changes in sort of your sort of response to different sort of chemical challenges, and you may be more vulnerable for years because you delayed, you know, getting that early and aggressive treatment.
And I want to make the push that people even more so should go ahead and get the treatment that you need, because if we think about it from a logical standpoint, in our physical body, you know, we're going to the gym, working out, but actually our greatest tool as humans is our mind. And to your point, right, if our brain which is the beginning, it's the thought, and then from that we do our action, is not functioning correctly, not because of us, just because of something beyond our capacity, it's imperative on us to do the work to better that, so yeah, our production can be better.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think that that's exactly right. I mean, imagine, again, I always use the diabetes example. If somebody develops risk factors for type 2 diabetes, right, a huge number of people in the population have this. If somebody develops risk factors and they take care of themselves, they can actually prevent the illness. If they develop type 2 diabetes and then they, you know, tightly manage it, correctly manage it, they can prevent all the long-term consequences. They won't have premature cardiovascular disease. They won't have eye, kidney, nerve problems. I think you see the very same thing with mental health issues. If we can prevent it, perfect. If we recognize it early, but then really manage it well, you can avoid a lot of the long-term impacts that people would otherwise see, not only on themselves, Moshe, but also on their families.
Yeah. And I know, you know, I keep thinking about this over these 19 months being, you know, during COVID, there must have been tremendous impact on Thriving Mind and probably in nationwide. What are you seeing on your side, the impacts that COVID had?
No, COVID was a strange thing. The biggest impact, if you just look sort of like numbers, who changed? The biggest impact, interestingly, was the people who didn't previously have a mental health condition. Mm. And now, because of the stress and the new anxiety and the trouble, now all of a sudden, somebody who, a man or a woman who was doing really pretty well before, suddenly was having anxiety or depression that they were never having before. Wow. Right. So that was a new onset problem versus a lot of the people that we treat have been struggling with a very serious mental illness or substance use problem for a long time. And interestingly, those folks stayed engaged in treatment. You know, the people, it's kind of like, again, diabetes. Like if you were already engaged and taking care of your diabetes, COVID made it harder to see your doctor. Okay. But you generally stayed in the ballgame. We struggled in our system to make sure people kept seeing their doctor.
Obviously, this is a very specific space. For you personally, why do you find that this is this space is your calling?
You know, I think we as you said, we all have friends and family who have been touched, you know, by you know, mental illness, mental health issues. But I'm very passionate about the idea that while we know a lot about cardiovascular disease and diabetes, and what we know has largely been translated into treatment, and what you see in practice in you know, the Western world is largely, you know, that knowledge being brought to bear, you know, and changing outcomes. But for mental health, back to your point about stigma and access issues, for mental health, we know so much at this point, and it's extremely frustrating that we are not providing all the treatment to all the people who could clearly benefit from it. So to me, this is low-hanging fruit.
I do have to say, I'm seeing on the ground, we talk about stigma lowering. You say a full kind of full court press over, let's say, over the past 10 years, I do see it slowly dropping. There is more conversation, there's more awareness, less stigma, and more access. And I do believe, I think it's even right, private insurance is accepting, you know, kind of covering for those things, which is all blessings for people. It's definitely, but we have a lot more work to do, but definitely I'm seeing that. Maybe a couple of success stories that you've seen working in Thriving Mind?
Listen, we're blessed to see success stories every day. You know, again, these are treatable medical conditions. You know, once somebody develops one of these things, remember, everybody on the planet feels anxiety. Everybody on the planet knows what you mean when you speak in their language and you talk about feeling sad or feeling depressed. What I think you and I are talking about today is preventing people from going to from the normal range of anxiety and depression into where their brain has really rounded a corner. Our language uses the same word, you know, depression, for the normal mood range and then this serious medical condition. And what we want to do is educate folks that at a certain stage, you've crossed a line. You now have something that you're not just going to be able to power your way out of, brute force, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get out of it. You're going to actually need some help. And we want to make sure that folks get the help they need.
So if you had your wish list with Thriving Mind here in South Florida, what would that look like? And how could that be a kind of model for the rest of the country?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It's a teaser. I mean, look, we're in a state where we probably need more resources, you know, and we could just build. We've got a great system, but we need capacity expansion. Sure. I will say that Miami does some things that are really innovative. We're one of like six cities that are being used as model cities around the country right now to talk about how we decriminalize, you know, mental illness. When somebody is in a crisis, unfortunately, you know, in our country, everybody has been trained to call 911.
Right.
And when they call 911 and you've got somebody who in fact is just having a mental health crisis, I think everybody has seen in the news that sometimes law enforcement and we have wonderful friends and partners in law enforcement in Miami, you know, the wrong experts, the wrong people get, you know, directed to go out and take the call. We are working to develop either co-responder models or first responder models where clinicians go out and see people who are in crisis. And we have done an amazing job, I think, in Miami over the last 10 years in bending the curve about how many people get arrested. You know, and instead get diverted into treatment. But Moshe, so much work to be done.
Yes.
And I think you and I talked about before the podcast, there is a national 988 number that the federal government has said will go live in July of 2022. And maybe we can talk again in the future. That's going to be a fast moving topic. Lots of work to be done in communities across the country to make sure that we're ready for that implementation. And I think good conversations about the best way to do it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's definitely eye-opening. And I want to really thank you, John, for coming on the show. How can the listeners find out more about Thriving Mind?
Thrivingmind.org is the website where you'll find out all the services that we provide and lots of links. Not only to local services for people who are listening to your broadcast here from Florida, from South Florida, but also for people listening nationally. I think we've got national links to resources, but I think it's also a good model. Like I said, we're in lots of national conversations now and being used as a reference point, you know, in what we're calling a learning collaborative model with the National Council for Well-Being and also the American Psychiatric Association sort of policy arm, trying to figure out how to advance this topic in the U.S.
Well, thank you so much, John. It's really, really been great. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for everything you do, Moshe.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Common Denominator Podcast. Join us next week for another inspiring, impactful, and empowering conversation. To learn more about Moshe, head to moshepopak.com. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it. And we'd be grateful if you could rate, review, and subscribe to the show.